Theory is popularly used in place of the term hypothesis. This is crucial. The notion that elements of the military were involved in the murders of the 11th of September is not a theory. It is an hypothesis which is supported, it seems to me, by overwhelming evidence. Popularly used in place of the term hypothesis, making rational debate almost impossible by blocking the necessary progression from observation to hypothesis to testing to theory. A theory is still rightly called a theory long after it has been proven, even to the limits of human understanding. It doesn't indicate that we can't tell. I cannot prove with utter certainty that I have never been on the planet Neptune. David Hume pointed this out in the 18th century. But it would be meaningless to doubt it. It is as certain as any grounds I could give for it. Everything speaks for it, and nothing speaks against it. Einstein's theory of relativity, Darwin's theory of evolution are incomplete because they are human products. There is no omniscience, but that omniscience is not required for the kind of knowledge that is worthy of that word. The public figures that theory means we don't know what we're talking about, but in fact we do. Now, if accounts of events like 9/11 are not theories, but are hypotheses, then what in this domain is appropriately called a theory? Well, Peter Dale Scott's notion of deep politics seems to me genuinely theoretical, and what it says is that these moments of collaboration and theft, fraud, and murder are not exceptional episodes. At the beginning of my presentation, I repeated a number of times the fact that the word conspiracy in the popular mind means a special episode which is an exception to the usual flow of events. Deep politics, instead, is an ongoing, systemic set of relationships. At the local level, it's exemplified, for instance, by the cooperation between a police force of a city or a neighborhood and the drug-dealing infrastructure, which sells crack on the street for $5 so that everybody can afford it and wrecks everybody's life. If the police have an arrangement with the kingpins in the neighborhood, who are not engaged in importing, even they are not that high up, then the kingpins in the neighborhood hand over to the police their subordinates and their competitors, and some crack and some money. If it's prostitution, then their sexual favors. If it's gambling, then it's opportunities to play and a portion of the proceeds. Whatever nefarious illegal activity it is, buys off the official agency which ought to regulate it. That's a neighborhood example. The national example, the international example, has to do not with some local drug dealing on the street, running of some secret network of prostitution on the block, but instead the international heroin trade, the cocaine trade, the arms trade, the smuggling of human beings, traffic in human organs, the freedom to suppress union movements, like the efforts of the Colombian people to organize unions in Coca-Cola bottling companies, where the union leaders are murdered. And then the next person with some political courage, like you, steps up to the plate and says, "You people are killing us. We need an 8-hour day." And then more right-wing death squads, often trained by the United States, come in and kill them too. Why? Because of the cooperation between authorities and the criminals I've described, whom they are supposed to regulate. There's an Enron example, and there's the JFK example beneath it. I won't read these, but the point of them is that Enron, engaging in criminal activity, in cooperation with Arthur Andersen, another private firm engaging in criminal activity, is merely a conspiracy, an important one, a venal one, a harmful one. But it's deep politics because it bought the United States government. The second example is not business plus business, But a government plus government, in a criminal conspiracy, a core of Secret Service personnel, and you can see the work of Vince Palomara for more about the Secret Service role in the JFK murder, conspired with elements of the CIA. Both are portions of the government, but this is deep politics because it also reached out to and made use of non-governmental criminal elites. This sums up what I tried to articulate a moment ago. When evidence is found to be genuine and then gathered together into a narrative, the result is an hypothesis. Was 9/11 a conspiracy that included elements of the US government? Damn right it was. Aren't such conspiracies impossible to prove? No. Hundreds of them have been proven, some in a court of law. Does the government have to be involved in a crime for it to be a conspiracy? No, it doesn't. And why does the notion of conspiracy have such a bad reputation as a way of explaining events that do involve the government? Because of psyops, because of psychological operations, because powerful elites are so successful at marginalizing their critics. Now, I'm interested in the way that the public is manipulated in the management of its own psyche, and I'm interested in the processes by which the psyche of a corrupt official melds itself to his or her opportunism. How do they sleep at night? I'm interested in the question, how they sleep at night, just as I'm interested in the question, as I have been all my life, why does the majority of the electorate empower figures who defeat their interests? Why elect Reagan, who wrecked the social system, who thrust the government into debt, who took all our money and built horrible weapons of death to go kill our relatives across the ocean? It turns out it has everything to do with identity politics and with our notions of just authority. It has to do, indeed, I submit, and this insight is hardly unique to me, I've learned it from others, and I never tire of saying whom I've learned it from and which books contribute to this understanding. Parenting. Authoritarian parenting causes people to espouse punitive social policies. Authoritative parenting causes people to espouse a notion of justice which is less retributive than it is rehabilitative. If you transgress and you get an ass whipping, you want to whip ass. If you transgress and the rules are explained to you and you are given a timeout and assured that the relationship is not broken and there will be another chance, why then you don't want to break the relationship. You want to teach. You want to heal people out of their disaster. Whereas our prisons, which are now larger per capita in our population than in any other countries in the world, are schools for crime and abuse. Here are these defense mechanisms. Just as the body has to breathe and eat, the psyche has to defend itself. But these defenses also create waste products, like breathing and eating, that are easily detected in a person's verbal and physical behavior. And the more neurotic the person is, the more difficult it is to miss the operation of those defense mechanisms. For instance, projection, in which I externalize my unconscious wishes or my desires or my fears or my fantasies onto other people because I cannot own up to them. This quotation has been on our minds ever since the president-elect opened his mouth and made this astonishing performance. Away from the guilty. Away from the guilty. Away from the guilty. Nobody forced him to say this. He came out with this on his own. This is the stinking radioactive waste washing around at the bottom of his soul, and he had to cart it away somehow. We must speak the truth about terror. Translation, we must never speak the truth about terror. Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories. Let us only tolerate our conspiracy theories. concerning the attacks of September 11th, our official account is a malicious lie that attempts to shift the blame away from the terrorists themselves, whom we see in the mirror in the Oval Office, away from the guilty. The defense mechanism of projection is exemplified here in a series of items. The cheat is sure that everyone else is dishonest. The aggressive man accuses other people of being hostile. And people project most often when they are naive about their own inner lives. When a person lacks insight into his own impulses and traits. The nature of the terrorists, said the president at a joint news conference with the British Prime Minister, is evidenced once again. We see their utter contempt for innocent life, and then you pop in the tape into the VCR about the Iraq War, and you see the tears, blood and sword and fire, utter contempt for innocent life. They hate freedom. They hate freedom. I'm the dictator. Remember that one? In projective identification, unlike simple projection, I don't fully disavow what's projected, but I say I got it from you. And then nobody can tell who got it from whom. Because in engaging in this act of projection, I cause you to exhibit the characteristic that I have projected. These are the worst of a very bad lot. Now, they may in fact have been goat herders. But if instead these were people who were reading the training manuals in Afghani schools, which were in fact vitriolic with hatred and bigotry and a passionate embrace of violence, because there really is an Islamic extremism out there, just as there is this equally rabid Zionist extremism in the state of Israel. And this is something which touches me rather deeply because, like so many of my countrymen, I am a Jew, but I ain't no Zionist, and I am an American, but I ain't no nationalist. These are the worst of a very bad lot. They are very dangerous. These are bad people. How did they get that way? They may well have information. Yes, they may. We're now trying to figure out when the next big attack is coming. There are many of us who have hypothesized that it could be as soon as June 6th. I sit at the feet of those investigators and continue to learn about it. They, the great they, in the Pentagon may well have information about future terrorists' attacks on the United States. Here's a defense mechanism about which you don't hear much. The individual deals with emotional conflict or stressors by feeling and acting as if he or she possesses special powers. God put me in the Oval Office to sit in the chair with my feet up on President Kennedy's desk and smirk at the world. Of course not. Asked by Bob Woodward whether he talked with staff and advisors about what he was doing and why. Of course not, he said. I'm the commander. See, the imagination stalls before the mystery of this sort of behavior. It's just astonishingly beyond the pale of what you associate with a rational adult. I'm the commander. See, I don't have to explain why I say things. That's the in case you were wondering what the interesting thing is about holding the office which was once occupied by Thomas Jefferson, the interesting thing is that I don't have to explain, because it can't. Maybe somebody needs to explain to me why they say something, but I don't feel like I owe anybody an explanation. In splitting, lose the ability to perceive the shades of gray between, well, the shades of gray anywhere. when you're a five-year-old, you haven't developed the capacity to perceive moral complexity. So children's literature is about moral extremes. The villainess in 101 Dalmatians, or 1,000, I don't know how many Dalmatians there are, is named Cruella. Now, nobody gives birth to a baby girl and says, we'll call her Cruella. You know, people become nefarious, wicked, sadistic because of what they've been through, namely neglect and abuse. The great Australian anti-nuclear activist Helen Caldicott says, Paul Wolfowitz was once a tiny baby, sweet little baby, and then something happened to him. I don't know what happened to him, but something happened to him. Our responsibility is to rid the world of evil. Good luck doing that. Thanks for your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Jamie. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you.
And please stick around. We're going to open it up to the panel for 10 minutes, and then we're going to have some questions from the audience.
You've done a wonderful job in breaking down and deconstructing the term conspiracy theorist in the space of half an hour. You did a really fantastic job. And the one quote that you put up on the screen from President Bush, from his infamous speech, whereby he says, do not entertain conspiracy theories to explain 9/11, is a quote that we've seen many times over the past couple of days here at this inquiry, and we're bound to encounter it many more times because it really hits to the heart of the matter. That's when he subconsciously revealed his cards and revealed the fact that there really is a conspiracy that isn't the official conspiracy, the mainstream conspiracy involving Osama bin Laden that we've all been taught, but rather that there's a conspiracy that he himself is complicit in. What I want to raise with you is the subject of the resurrection of the term conspiracy theorist. Undoubtedly, there's been hundreds, if not thousands, perhaps an infinite number of conspiracies throughout history, because by definition, a conspiracy is simply two or more people gathering in secret to conduct an operation that perhaps the masses would not be otherwise happy with. Decades ago, conspiracy theory was such a dirty word that you dare not mention it in public and dare not raise it in any other sense other than a pejorative one. In the 1990s, the term began to see a kind of renaissance or resurrection following the quite overt announcement by President Bush Sr. of the imminent New World Order, which sort of brought things out into the open for the first time. And also during this period, the ever-popular show The X-Files, which brought the notion of conspiracy theory into popular consciousness. We've seen over the 1990s and into the 21st century a gradual breakthrough into the mainstream of the term conspiracy theory as a respectable term. And people like yourself have brought to light the fact that it's not that derogatory of a term, that in fact in the courts of law it's used all the time as the primary means of building a model for understanding how any crime occurs. Any crime is that involves more than two people a conspiracy. I'm wondering what sort of prospect you see from this inquiry of more fully resurrecting the term conspiracy theory, or whether that term should possibly be sidelined for something more digestible to the mainstream. How is it that we go about describing what really happened on 9/11 without having to resort to this pejorative term, conspiracy theory?
I think it's an excellent question, and I indicated at the beginning of my presentation that there are two ways to go. It's a kind of fork in the road. Either you rehabilitate the term by explaining just what you mean each time you use it, or you try and junk the term and get it out of the way. I think that latter strategy is best, so that verbs like collaborate, cooperate, phrases like break the law are probably better because they're more effective, because they go around this trigger. In a similar way, when I talk about Iraq, for instance, I like to refer to the people who die in that situation as ladies and gentlemen and kids, because if you say men, women, and children, people have just heard it too much. It's not their fault, but those words have been used so much that they've been polished to the point where their rhetorical surface just doesn't reflect any light at all. I think we should get rid of the word.
Jamie, it's absolutely wonderful to have you come here from the United States as a thinking American. Americans confuse us in Canada, to say the least. We have a strong anti-war movement, a strong anti-globalization movement. We have third world people who understand all about who organized the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and what it is doing to them. And this latest thing where we see on TV the torturing of the Iraqi prisoners, can we live in hope that the United States is overstretching itself geographically, economically, emotionally, that it's really going too far? Is there hope in that conspiracy theory? No, in that idea.
Yes. That's where the hope is. This can't go on. The military can't go on. Not only because it's ethically untenable, but it's approaching the limits of feasibility. I recommend a really wonderful book by Stan Gough, who writes for a number of publications, is also one of our authors on FromTheWilderness.com. He has a book called Full Spectrum Disorder, the military in the new American century. It's about the imperial overstretch. I recommend a book by Robert Duncan called The Dollar Crisis, Causes, Consequences, Cures, which explains that under the burden of a $500 billion trade deficit, American currency is propped up not by any gold reserves, which it lacks, but by military force. 9/11 was a trigger for a new openness in that economic underpinning of American economic strength. Now that it's on the table, that it's our horrible weapons of death which prop up this currency, it will be eventually unavoidable for Russia and Europe and, God willing, Canada to calibrate their exports in euros. When the Saudis stop selling oil in dollars, America will either suffer a depression, which will spread to the rest of the world, but ultimately liberate the rest of the world from the dead hand of American hegemony, or America will prevent that economic collapse of the dollar by marching into Saudi Arabia and shooting anything that moves. And it won't be able to do that if its military is torn to shreds in Fallujah and Najaf and Karbala.
Thank you, Jeremy, for your presentation this afternoon. When I was introduced, it was mentioned that I'm fairly new to some of these ideas. I have not been one who's been researching the skeptics movement for very long, but I'm being more and more impressed with what I'm finding out and what I'm hearing. One of my first reactions, however, a couple of months ago when someone told me some of the ideas they were having was, well, yes, and what do you think about UFOs? And so that it's that kind of reaction now that we need to overcome. Before you began speaking this afternoon, I had written down on my paper, why does what we call the truth matter as long as it is the truth? And I think you've addressed that rather well. What can you tell me about how you embolden yourself to speak to people who you know ahead of time or you sense immediately are reacting to you in a marginalizing way, that they're automatically discounting what you have to say as soon as they hear what it's about? And how do you react to that personally and overcome that so as to be taken seriously?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. Let me act out the answer to that, and I'm going to pretend that I'm at a cocktail party, and with my sleeves down, I am Jamie Hecht One, and I'm going to take part in a conversation in the way that triggers this conspiracy theory response, and then I'll roll my sleeves up and be Jamie Hecht Two, and I'll try and show how that response can be avoided. You know, I've been doing a lot of reading about this, and I'm really feeling persuaded. I haven't totally made up my mind, but I pretty much think that the government did it. I really think Bush knew. And, you know, there was a headline in the New York Post a few weeks after 9/11. I think they did it. There's a lot of evidence. You know, fascinatingly, I've been looking at books and articles and reading essays by people I respect whose achievements in other areas were already interesting to me, and I found out this strange thing. What do you think about this? Turns out, on the morning of 9/11, there were 4 war games scheduled by the military command, by NORAD, and these games involved pretending that there were hijacked airliners in the air. Well, it turns out there were hijacked airliners in the air, but the controller's screens not only had the blips indicating the actual 4 hijacked airliners, but another 11 to 21 blips, some of which corresponded to live fly real aircraft from a NORAD exercise, and some were virtual blips that corresponded to nothing from the, I think, NORTHCOM, I don't remember which. But isn't that amazing? I mean, imagine sitting at that instrument panel trying to scramble jets and not knowing whether it's a drill or not. And if it's not a drill, there are only 8 fighter aircraft left on the East Coast because the rest are all wargaming up in Canada pretending to fight the Russians on Operation Northern Guardian. That seems like a great way to shut down the people who want to do their jobs. Isn't that fascinating? I don't know what it means. Don't ask me. I don't know.
Thank you. I want to thank Jamie. Please come to the microphone. We have time for 2 very quick questions. Please keep your questions brief. Thank you.
Hello. I'm interested in the psychological impact that the conspiracy theory has on the populace so they buy into whatever is said. And the example I have, coming from South Africa, the way they created us versus them is the white government first called every or most of the blacks communists, but then they discovered that Reverend Luthuli and Father Huddleston were all Christians, and the international community said these people can't be communists, so they labeled us terrorists. And having labeled us terrorists, they could pick anybody and arrest them and do whatever they want, what is happening after 9/11. My question to you is, how do we, or what suggestion do you have so that we, the populace, do not fall into the trap of becoming influenced by the psychological influence so that we buy into their conspiracy theory and thereby become accomplice to their actions? Mm-hmm. And just before I finish, in the 9/11 situation, before 9/11, with the demise of the Soviet Union, they wanted to create a new enemy, and already with the clash of civilizations, they had identified the Muslims, and after the fact, that Muslims were now the enemy, it became very easy to identify them as the enemy. How do we overcome that or prevent that?
That question is probably more important than any answer I can bring to it. For one thing, I recommend a book. I'm a professor, that's what I do. In the face of any problem, I spit out a title and author and say, maybe this will help. The Cunning of History by Richard L. Rubinstein, who's a rabbi, and the subtitle is The Holocaust and the American Future. One of the things that he does in this book, which is about mass violence, not only the Nazi Holocaust against the Jews, but also the First World War, the Second World War that killed 20 million Soviets, and the Tuskegee syphilis experiments in which the United States injected black male prisoners with syphilis and then refused them medical treatment while pretending to do otherwise. That book argues that rather than being an exception to monotheist ethics of care, there's a strain in monotheism from its beginning in the Torah and Hebrew scriptures through the Pauline version of Christianity and into the Quran, where it is at least as loud, a strain of reward and punishment, of rule-bound bullying, and the heavy hand of a God whose judgment won't even obey his own rules and changes the rules in the middle of the game. And you can hear me using the language of authoritarian parenting as I talk about this. One way to keep on the lookout is to look sharp for the vicious legacy of white supremacy, which is the heaviest tool in the American political arsenal. And an interesting thing happened in the wake of 9/11. People began reading the Quran on the New York subway. People began reading about the history of Afghanistan. They began reading about whether the life of an Islamic woman in one or another of the many, many Islamic societies in the world might not be such a bad thing, though she lacks the specific prerogatives of her brothers. Could separate spheres nevertheless be a livable thing in which would be a woman could be happy because of privileges and prerogatives that are inside a female domain? Or is it that purdah is an enslavement from which everybody needs to be liberated? People became interested in these questions. That interest died because there's an intelligence tax in the United States where if you're stupid, I can trust you. If you eat beef, I can trust you. If you waste gasoline, I can trust you. You're not likely to confront me with the limitations of my action.
Thank you. And one very brief question, please.
I had a long question, so I'll make it brief as I can. But basically, I remember a talk by Noam Chomsky about the politics of language. And what he said was, if you use the same constraints on the argument that the opposition gives you, like conspiracy theory, and you have to explain conspiracy theory, you fall into their trap. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to throw out about three examples and let you comment on it.
Can you please just ask the question?
Yeah. Well, I can't. I mean, the thing is well, I'll give you the examples and let you comment on it.
Okay.
I don't call myself a conspiracy theorist. I call myself an investigative journalist.
Yep.
I call myself a researcher, a skeptic. I don't call the people who allegedly attacked the World Trade Center terrorist. If you look at it, they should be called counter-terrorists. I call myself an American, but last I saw the map, Mexicans are Americans. They were born in North America, and I think Canadians are Americans too. So,
America being a geographical right. Rather than a political term.
So
that's
Americans,
right.
It's a question of Americans understanding Americans. You know.
Sure. Yeah, America is a geographical term. The name derives from an Italian explorer named Amerigo Vespucci. And the United States has largely hijacked that term so that the A in USA has been appropriated so that our neighbors to the south and the north are not entitled to avail themselves of that word, and I think that clearly is a mistake. Nick?
What sense? Yeah, I'm just wondering.
We're out of time for questions.
It's really short. It's really, really short. And the question is, why do you think it is that when it involves communists, terrorists, foreigners, Arabs, Iraqis, Latin Americans, drug dealers, it's never called conspiracy? Or mafia, it's rarely called conspiracy. Everybody, it's
okay, I think
only
Jamie
called
gets
conspiracy
the point.
When
you
it's
make a quick
government.
Comment on that?
Yeah.
It's your own government.
People use the word conspiracy to refer to the wild hypothesis that those who have sworn to protect them are in fact using that authority to injure them. And the word conspiracy is a warm blanket that wards off that emotionally threatening possibility. It's all from family dynamics. That's why we behave the way they do. Look at the family, heal the family, be kind to one another, be gentle and decent, believe in the humanity of the other person even if she looks nothing like you, and all these grand, giant, murderous industrial schemes will gradually deflate.
I can't think of a better way to end off. Thank you very much, Jamie. Thank the panel.
That was Professor Jamie Hecht examining the term conspiracy theory. He spoke in Toronto on May 25th as part of Phase 2 of the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 FM in Ithaca, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. We'll conclude the program with Bill Douglas of 911visibility.org, a group devoted to applying pressure to bring out the unreported facts and questions surrounding 9/11.
Before I start into the presentation about what 911visibility.org is and what we try to offer, right before I left, I got a letter from Paul Lannoy, a member of the European Parliament, the European Union's Parliament. And I just want to read a little snippet from this letter that he asked me to read or to present in his place because he couldn't make it to this program. His letter is addressed, "Dear world legislators, parliamentarians, and world citizens, we have watched with alarm that the sad and tragic events of 9/11, 11 September 2001, have resulted in two wars and a global rollback in civil liberties. Iraq had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks, yet it has been attacked in the name of them. People in countries worldwide have suffered reduced civil liberties in the name of 9/11, and intelligence surveillance of ordinary citizens has expanded dramatically. I submit to you that before any more wars are launched or liberties are lost in the name of the war on terror launched by the Bush administration after 9/11, a full international inquiry into the events leading up to and on 9/11 be held, which includes 9/11 victims' family members from the U.S. and other nations. The National Green Party of the United States has requested an open, independent 9/11 investigation that would involve 9/11 victims' family members. This is a good start, but it must also be an international inquiry. In addition to that, it includes 9/11 family members from nations worldwide who lost loved ones in the 9/11 attacks. We need this to occur because many, including the 9/11 Family Steering Committee of the United States, are growing increasingly frustrated with the stunning lack of hard questions for witnesses appearing before the 9/11 Commission. Until these hard questions are asked and fully answered, we should refuse more wars and renounce reduced liberty worldwide in the name of 9/11 and its resultant war on terror." And he goes on, but that's essentially the gist of what European parliamentarian Paul Lannoy wanted me to convey to everybody here. It's hard for me to know, but I have a feeling that most people outside of the United States really didn't quite feel the intensity of what we felt on and after 9/11. I'm talking particularly about those of us that were waking up to the fact that there was a very high likelihood of complicity by our own government in the events that took place on 9/11. The chill that swept across the nation is really hard for me to describe. I do know that people outside of the United States felt it to some degree. The way that I got involved in the 9/11 truth issue on a large scale is because I was a member of the Society of Professional Journalists discussion group. They had picked up an opinion essay that I had published on Mexico News that was about the United States and where we were going to go as far as attacking other countries because of 9/11. And it was about that same time when the Society of Professional Journalists invited me to become part of their discussion group because of that essay, that I began to become aware of Barry Zwicker's video and Mike Rupert's research and other things that were essentially putting together a lot of facts that I had, you know, gathered through my interactions with other writers and other people. But they put it in a very succinct way with a timeline that just stunningly portrayed that there's a much higher likelihood of U.S. government complicity than there is of there not being complicity. So because of that, I began to put this information up on the Society of Professional Journalists discussion group, and I was assaulted by other, you know, quote-unquote professional journalists who called me things like an Arab terrorist mouthpiece and, you know, other things that were a little even more pointed than that. The thing about it is they never dealt with the facts that I was putting up, because I was very careful to just put up cold facts. And so eventually what happened was these other journalists started screaming to the moderator. The moderator eventually kicked me off of the Society of Professional Journalists. And so I realized that we were being betrayed by our media. I wholly believe that part of it is there's an infiltration of American media. I just finished reading part of a book about when the United States overthrew the elected democracy in Iran back in the 50s. And the author of the book pointed out that before the CIA or U.S. government agencies overthrew the democracy in Iran, they had infiltrated 75% of the Iranian media. So if you think about it, if they put all that effort into infiltrating the media of a small third world country, I mean, I think you'd have to be naive not to assume that they've done it to the media in the United States. But I think there's more to it than that. I think there's an incredible Orwellian doublethink that goes on in the U.S. media, because people know on some deep primordial level what it's going to take for them to keep their jobs. And the only way that they can sleep at night, the only way that they can look at themselves in the mirror, is to do a doublethink where they really convince themselves and believe the lies and fabrications and distortions that they're fed by the current administration. Once I realized that we were being betrayed by the media, we launched the 9/11 Visibility Project, or the 911visibility.org. At the time, we hadn't quite formulated what it was, but we knew that we had to become the media. And so what we did was we began to email the 9/11 facts as they were emerging and recommend videos like Barry Zwicker's video, The Great Deception, and Nafiz Ahmed's book, The War on Freedom, when it came out, and websites like Mike Rupert's website. And all the 9/11 information that was emerging, we started blasting it out to media worldwide, and we accumulated tens of thousands of email addresses for media. And we didn't just collect the email addresses for editors, but for secretaries and anybody that had an email address at a given paper or television network or whatever, because we wanted to begin to embarrass the editors about sitting on this story. We wanted every one of their fellow employees to know the facts, and for them to have to walk past all these people to the water fountain or to the bathroom every day, essentially with their head hanging in shame. And so that was how 911visibility.org got started. At the time when we first started it, it was a terrifying thing to be doing that in the United States, because right after 9/11, Bush came out and he said, "You're either with us or against us." And Ashcroft came out and he said, "We're going to be reading your email and we're going to be listening to your phone calls. Anybody who stands up against what we want to do is aiding and abetting the enemy." So, you know, we just all assumed that we were being watched. And so it was a very terrifying thing to start to reach out. But now it's become a wildfire. The speed that the truth about 9/11 is beginning to spread, especially in the last few months, is really quite staggering. Like Paul Lannoy mentioned in his statement to us, the National Green Party of the United States has now called for a full new independent 9/11 investigation that would involve 9/11 family members. Ed Asner, the actor that was gained fame through the Mary Tyler Moore Show, who's been a peace activist, peace and justice activist for many, many years, has come out and officially endorsed the 9/11 movement. Of course, now the European parliamentarian that's supporting our efforts. Most recent thing that we were able to do is we started a lobbying campaign to organize people to contact Democracy Now. Do you listen to Democracy Now up here? One of the really terrifying things was that the alternative media in the United States really not only ignored this story, but in some cases absolutely sabotaged 9/11 truth from coming out. One of the most horrendous events, or most terrifying events for me personally, was Mike Rupert had written some very thoughtful research about 9/11 and the obvious discrepancies in the official 9/11 story. And David Korn, or the Nation editor of the Nation magazine, came out and did a scathing attack on Mike Rupert. And he didn't deal with any of the facts that Mike Rupert had put out there. It was just a pure character assassination. One of the first lobbying campaigns that we did was we started, asking people. What we did was we collected email addresses of people that were supportive of us and created an internet and telephone and fax lobbying army that we could essentially unleash on anybody and everybody where we thought pressure being applied might have some impact. David Korn was one of the first ones that we did, and so we asked people en masse to start sending David Korn 9/11 facts as they emerge. And we asked him to put in the subject line, "David, could you read this before you character assassinate the author of it?" The damage that David Korn did to the 9/11 truth movement is something staggering. It's been a real struggle getting the mainstream peace and justice movement in the United States to comprehend that 9/11 is the quintessential issue of the peace and justice movement. Because essentially what they did with when they were broadcasting those images to the American public over all the networks for hours and hours and hours and days and days and days, was they were imprinting on people's minds a consciousness that would make them capable of becoming much more savage than they ever would have been under any other circumstances. And I wholly believe it was designed that way, and it was designed to do that. And it had its effect. I remember I started watching the CBC on my cable news because I couldn't stand to watch the American media anymore. And although I know that the Canadian media has had some suppression as well, because I was in contact with a writer for one of the major Canadian newspapers, and he had written a piece, some of you may recognize it, but it was a piece that compared the 9/11 truth movement to like an X-Files investigator, so it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing. But within this article, this tongue-in-cheek article, he put all the pertinent 9/11 facts. And then at the bottom of it, he put my email address, which was findtruth40@hotmail.com. And he said, if you want more information on this 9/11 issue, you contact this email. So I got up in the morning and I went to check my email, and I had like 2,000 emails. And they were all from Canadians. So I emailed people back and I said, how did you find out my email address? And they said, oh, the article. And so I traced it and, found out that it came from a major publication. I called up the writer, thanked him for giving out the email address because all these people wanted more information. So they were able to read through the bias of the obvious bias of the story to the real facts. And so what this writer confided in me was that that's the only way that he could write the story and get the facts out without it being censored by his editor. And this was a Canadian newspaper. And he said that actually Canadian journalists had been fired for trying to broach this story in Canadian media. So you take that and you multiply it by 1,000, and then you have an awareness of what was going on in the United States at that time. So what we're doing right now is we're dramatically enlarging this internet activist force that we can focus people's energy. One of the things that's happened through the 9/11 truth movement is the researchers and the writers who've really made the 9/11 truth movement possible have in some cases amassed massive email lists of thousands or tens of thousands of people. But what we saw with 9/11 visibility was that in a lot of cases, these massive, armies, if you will, of 9/11 potential 9/11 activists, they weren't actually activated. They were getting a lot of information from researchers, which is really important, but they weren't being empowered to take the next step, which was to apply pressure en masse to pressure points in the media so that we could begin to force this story to be broken. One of the successes that we just had recently was we did a campaign called Waking Amy, and so now I'm back to Democracy Now!, which is where I started with all this. We had the email addresses for all the staff people at Democracy Now!, and we asked people to write Amy and write the staff and thank them for the work that they do, but to extol them to begin to dig deeper into the 9/11 cover-up issue, and to more specifically bring Ellen Mariani and Phil Berg and David Ray Griffin on the show. We were really quite stunned because it was successful. And so Amy had Phil and Ellen on the show last week, and if everything goes right, she's going to be interviewing David Ray Griffin tomorrow. So the power that we have is so extraordinarily incredible with the internet. The information exchange of the internet is only half of the game. The other half of the game is creating an activist army that we can mobilize and we can apply pressure. Another example of what we did was Phil Donahue, who had a talk show in the United States until he brought Kristen Bruttweiser, the 9/11 widow, who was one of the Jersey girls who forced the creation of the 9/11 Commission. Phil Donahue had Kristen Bruttweiser on his program. Once that happened, we encouraged all of the people who had signed up with their email address at 911visibility.org to begin emailing all the major networks and all the major talk show hosts and saying, look, Phil Donahue had the courage to talk to these people. Why don't you show that same courage and bring these 9/11 widows on to talk about their struggle against the Bush administration to try to get a 9/11 investigation. Apparently, it was vastly successful because we got contacted from the Boston Globe, and a writer at the Boston Globe wanted to do a story. And she said the networks are getting buried in demands that they bring the 9/11 families onto their shows. So bringing this pressure to bear is a way that we can, put a shiv in a crack and break that door open. We can't take on, the government or the media in a wailing against the wall kind of way. It just won't work. But there are windows of opportunity. Like, for example, when the 9/11 Commission was going to have, or they weren't going to have Condoleezza Rice come and testify. And then they were going to have her testify, but it was going to be behind closed doors and she wasn't going to be under oath. And so we launched a campaign where we had all these people email, fax, and phone the 9/11 Commission, and also the top two Democrats and the top two Republicans, and demand that Condoleezza Rice testify in public under oath in front of the whole commission. And they relented. And we knew it was having an incredible impact because when we would call these offices ourselves, the staff would just be exhausted from, taking these demands for 9/11 truth. All day long, day after day after day. So there's these. So we got Condoleezza Rice under oath, testifying in public. And then, once that happened, then it became increasingly apparent to a lot of people that she was lying. And now we've got Sybil Edmonds, the FBI translator, who's come forward and said that Condoleezza Rice was lying, that they had multiple warnings of the coming attacks. Now, Ashcroft is trying to shut her up. And they're trying to create a gag order. And so that is another place where we can apply some great pressure. Now, Sybil Edmonds, from the last I heard, she's going to defy the gag order. And she's going to risk imprisonment to testify to the 9/11 families that are suing the Bush administration. The core of my appeal to everybody that I talk to is to go to 911visibility.org and enter your email address there so that you can get on our action alert list. But then the next step is to become an internet activist and to get this information out as wide and far as you possibly can to encourage as many people as you possibly can to come onto it. One thing that I always like to ask people is, have any of you been in an internet chat room arguing politics with anybody lately? Anybody out there? Well, a lot of us do that, and I encourage you to stop doing that, because we're never going to convince those people that we argue with. But what we can do is we can go into chat rooms, and we can find people that already have a high suspicion of the Bush administration, and we can connect with them and get them and lead them to the websites and inform them and ask them if we can put them in our address book under 9/11 activists, and then we can keep growing this thing. Another thing that we've done is we started contacting. We found out that you could mine the database of Howard Dean supporters. So there's tens of thousands of Howard Dean supporters, and we went and met with Howard Dean supporters in our local cities about the 9/11 issue, and most of them are pretty savvy, and most of them are ready to do something on the issue. So you can go into the Dean for America website, and you can go through there, and you can email thousands of Dean supporters and get them involved in the 9/11 truth movement. And there's a myriad of other ways that you can utilize the internet so that you can, within a period of weeks, activate thousands of people who kind of already agree with us, but they're just not involved. Because it's not enough just to educate them. We've got to actually create this massive movement where we can apply this pressure at these key points. It's kind of like political judo. When you're taking on a giant, you don't want to just stand there and kick the giant in the shin. But if there's an Achilles heel where you can, put a spear in and do a little prodding, then that's where you want to put your energy. And so that's what 9/11 visibility is all about, is enabling those of us who feel disempowered and feel like we can't make a difference to find those very key points where we can insert with a short, sharp shove a massive push and force more information out than they would be comfortable getting out if we weren't forcing that to happen. And little by little, we start to chip away to the point where I feel, to be honest with you, that when I see Rumsfeld and I see Bush and I see Cheney and I see Wolfowitz and these guys come out and in front of the public, I feel like they're terrified. When I saw Ashcroft testify in front of the 9/11 commission, he was trembling. And the more I watched it, the more obvious it was. I had never seen him like that before. These folks are on the ropes, and we can actually stop a fascist takeover. But it's going to take a lot of work. Over the last 2 years, I've put thousands of thankless grunt work hours in front of my computer, just mining email addresses and emailing people a website, 911visibility.org website to get involved. And there's really no glitz and glamour to it at all. It's just a bunch of grunt work. And we need Canadians desperately to help us hammer the media and the government and the 9/11 Commission, because we need them to know that the world is watching. And it's not just us. It's not just us in the United States. And the biggest support that we had from the very beginning, like I said, after that Vancouver Sun article, was Canadians. And I'll just wrap up with one quick little story here, just to really show you how the potential power of this. We did this one focus because we were working with an Australian activist, and he was trying to get the Australian media to break open on the 9/11 truth story. And so we did this focus, and we had gotten all these emails from Canadians, and so we added them to our list. And so our list was primarily Canadians. We had, different people from around the world, but it was the biggest chunk was Canadians. And so we started this campaign on the Australian media to try to get them to cover the issue, because the 9/11 families in Australia have been totally dishonored by Howard. They've been treated by Howard in Australia as badly as Bush has treated the 9/11 families in the United States. And so we were trying to push the Australian media, and so we unleashed this lobbying campaign to get everybody to contact the Australian media. And so this one Australian activist contacted us, and he goes, there's this little newspaper in the town in Australia that I live in, and they don't do any regional or national news, and so they can't really have an impact on this. But they're begging you to get them taken off of this list, because their email boxes are getting buried with these irate emails coming from Canadians that want them to cover the 9/11 truth issue. So you see what we can do. And so 911visibility.org, I encourage everybody to go there, sign up with your email address, and encourage as many people as possible to go to 911visibility.org and sign up their email address. And another thing that we're doing right now is we've gathered 15,000 9/11 truth petition signers' postal addresses, and we're databasing them, and so within the next 2 months we'll be sending cards to all those folks, so we could bump up these numbers significantly. So when we do this, and when we get other people to do it, realize that we're getting tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people to do this when we do it. So it's so important to feel empowered in this age where we've got leaders that are trying to make us feel as powerless as possible. So thank you very much for giving me this opportunity.
And that was Bill Douglas speaking on May 25th at Phase 2 of the International Inquiry into the Unanswered Questions of 9/11, held in Toronto. Thanks to Homooks, Roy and Karen Harvey, and the Phase 2 video team for providing us with the material. For more information on the 9/11 Inquiry, visit 911inquiry.org. And thanks to David Rovics, whose music was used in tonight's program. For more on David's music, visit davidrovics.com. Rovics is spelled R-O-V-I-C-S. And to contact this program or download past shows from our archive, visit us on the web at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Hey!